Welcome to OK Team, a young designer's guide with your hosts Mark Sela, Kristen Paraclios, and Dan Lawson. If you could take a moment and follow us on your favorite podcast provider, it would help us a lot and it'll keep you up to date when we have new episodes. This is episode 18, Accessibility and Design.
I drove to Fort Wayne last week for a dining set.
Thanks. Thanks for stopping by.
I was nowhere near you.
You were in Indiana. That's all that counts.
I was near South Bend.
Are you closer than where you live now? Yes.
Well,
let's face it. I wear on people. I know this.
Also, I don't. Oh, I do know where you live. I sent you mail.
You did.
I know exactly.
You did. Exactly where you live. We have a podcast to do here.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we're doing.
I am not qualified for this job, actually.
You're selling yourself short. Dan, you haven't met her in person yet. She is a little bit taller than an iPhone, not the Max, but a little taller than an iPhone.
See, like you'd...
If there were two of them, she could be the good and bad devil and angel that sit on your shoulder.
So like you had said something, not last week, but when you did the guest spot, you had said something about being like really short. And for some reason, I've just like always like, because I've only ever seen like this much of you. I've always just assumed you were like really tall. I don't know why.
Well, I get that a lot, actually. So a lot of my like remote coworkers have said that I have like 5'10" energy.
Yeah.
And what you a do, compliment.
You do have the presence of a much physically taller individual. I have to remind myself that you are shorter because you, I always picture you being like here to me.
Yeah, no, I'm 5'1".
I'll never forget the first time I met one of our clients. They were a local like nonprofit that just like did like work in the community arts and whatever. We were working on an app for them and I went to one of their events and she looks at me and she goes, "Lauren, you're so short." This woman was shorter than I am. Like, I'm like, you literally, Kathy, you can't say anything right now because I'm looking down at you currently.
But oddly enough, Lauren, until you pointed it out, I never thought you were short until you pointed it out. And then I was like, holy crap, you're short. But Dan here is very tall.
How tall
are you? Average. I'm average tall.
Average.
I'm 6'2".
6'2
is average tall, I think, right?
I agree.
6'2?
6'5. 6'5 is like tall.
But I don't know if that's average height. Well, what is average height?
I don't know.
Average height for men is like, globally, it's like 5'8". I think in the United States, it's like 5'10".
See, but I feel like Dan is ginormous.
I know a ton of people that are like 6'1 to 6'2.
Are you sure? Or are you just that small?
I play a sport that benefits tall people. I hang out with a lot of tall folks.
You know what, though, Lauren? It's really not that hard for you to hang out with a lot of tall people. I'm just saying.
I mean...
What do you mean? Oh,
everyone's taller than you.
Oh, that's true.
You're like a lot of tall people. I was at a sixth grade luncheon and all these kids were so tall. They just kept handing me around.
I didn't realize I was short until people in high school started like making fun of me for it. And I was like, what do you mean? And then I realized that I had to look up at everyone.
Okay, team. Accessibility in design. Speaking of someone who cannot reach high shelves, inaccessible. Lauren DeMarks.
I'm back.
She's back. It's Dan, Lauren DeMarks, and myself this week. We're talking about accessibility. So does this mean like, hey, we're designing something to where you can reach that book on the top shelf?
Oh my God.
When we talk about accessible design, what exactly... In your professional experience, does accessibility and design mean?
Yeah. So accessibility in design is really just the practice of making sure that a product or an environment or a service can be used by anyone and everyone, regardless of how they encounter it or interact with it. These typically accommodate folks that have blindness or low vision, speech, hearing impairments, cognitive and learning disabilities, or motor and dexterity impairments as well. Accessible design just kind of makes it so that all of these folks can actually meaningfully use the design solutions that we create. Accessible design is also important in all elements and all disciplines within design. And that's pretty much what we're going to cover today, going from print and digital all the way to environmental and physical product accessibility. Basically, when you think about accessibility, folks most likely think of permanent disabilities, like folks that use wheelchairs or folks that are blind and can't see. But there's actually different kinds of impairments that accessible design can successfully address. So these are situational, temporary, and permanent. So to describe these, I might say that a situational impairment is, you know, me walking in high heels and making it a little bit more difficult to walk. A temporary impairment would be like, my foot's broken. And a permanent impairment would be like, I'm paralyzed and I no longer have the use of my legs. Those are all different scenarios where someone might have limited use of their foot or leg, but they affect the individual in different ways. And so that's just kind of a way of saying that accessible design is a lot more broad than I think a lot of people believe at first when they're exposed to it for the first time.
How do you approach individuals respectfully who may have these types of impairments and not bring any of preconceived notions about their disability? Mm-hmm. So before you show a design to an individual who may have some type of physical disability, how do you arrive at that design solution without relying on stereotypes? What type of research do you do instead of just saying, I'm assuming that this individual is going to have a problem with X, Y, and Z? How do you arrive at that?
There's a lot of really good resources out there. There's actually written guidelines for how to design, in my line of work, like digital interfaces for different kinds of disabilities. And so from that standpoint, a lot of it is more or less defined. Like we know mm-hmm. that in order to accommodate folks that use screen readers, like a product has to be coded in a, what's the word? The syntax has to be written in the code in a certain prescriptive way. Like we know that because that's, we know how screen readers work. If we're working with folks or we know the people using our product might be colorblind, well, we know what colors together can be problematic. And so in a way, you know, those kind of guidelines for me have kind of eliminated the concern of coming into the design process with that kind of bias, because a lot of really smart people have kind of solved a lot of those problems already.
How far does empathy go before you need the experience of what these yep. individuals mm-hmm. deal with? Dennis, who you and I both know from Miami, would literally put people in a wheelchair and was like, go up there, try and get in both of the doors without any help. Yep. And what I found interesting about that was that it wasn't just a physical challenge, but I can imagine if I wasn't able-bodied, it would have been frustrating and embarrassing that these accommodations in this day and age had not been made. Mm-hmm. And it was kind right. of like, you know, yeah. what is this? I hit the button and the door opens on me. Mm-hmm. You know, that type of thing I found very interesting.
Yeah. And I've been to workshops where we do similar exercises. There was one I went to for, I think, a Cincinnati Design Week event several mm-hmm. many years ago now, where, you know, like we put on blindfolds and like had to kind of navigate an app using like the voice dictation And you could really, really feel how inadequate that experience was. And that's unfortunately, just because I think, like, as much as we want to empathize with everyone, it does sometimes take actually experiencing that for a little bit to really understand it is like to kind of have that subpar experience. Sometimes it even just takes a situational impairment. Like when I still lived in apartments, I was really, really thankful for our elevator when I had to carry bags and bags of groceries to my 7th story apartment. So, you know, it's like those exercises do help you kind of empathize with those users in that way.
What would be really frustrating about the example used with the door and the ramp is that the reason it's happening is because of fire codes, doors have to open out. Exit doors have to open out because it's a fire code thing. Mm-hmm. If there's a panic and there's a rush up against the door is going to open out and people can just flood out. So I get it. That makes sense. It is so frustrating.
But you know what the problem was? The ramp goes up on the side of the door that has the hinges. It's L-shaped.
Oh, my word.
It's L-shaped. And it's right like in front of the
I see.
Yeah, so it's L-shaped. And at the end of the L, it's like an inverted L.
Right.
At the end of the L is where the button is. The door opens on you. And if you're directly in front of it, there's a set of stairs, a small set of stairs that are right behind you. So either you go backwards in the ramp or you go down the stairs or the door just hits you. Yeah, it was a bizarre accessibility issue. But you're right. It would be very easy to fix.
In UX design, like, and honestly, this goes for all design disciplines. But regardless, that's just something that you catch if you test it. Like, knowing that that is how that built environment was created just kind of proves that no one tested it out from that perspective.
And it's amazing how many buildings that you see that if you imagine going to that building with some type of mobility disability, if you park in the main parking lot and you try and actually get into the building, it has to be incredibly difficult.
Well, you know what, Mark? I'm going to actually use a similar example to highlight that making something technically accessible does not mean that it is a sufficient experience because, you know, there's a restaurant in Oxford that is in a basement. So typically in order to access this restaurant, you would go down a couple of flights of stairs and that's, you know, where you like get seated and everything. Obviously, if you have mobility impairment, you are using a wheelchair or just crutches or just like have a sore foot, those stairs are going to be challenging for you.
Yeah.
But their accessible, quote, accessible entrance is actually around the corner in an alley, part of another building, and you have to take the elevator basically in the back of the restaurant. And while, yes, that technically makes this establishment accessible, it does not make the built environment an equal experience for everybody.
Yeah.
And that's really also what accessible design is all about, is like not highlighting someone's disability when they use the thing.
Yeah. And something that you and I knew about, a certain place doesn't have a women's restroom on a floor that has, you know, over 90% women. And it was kind of like, wasn't unexpected to see women in the men's restroom because sometimes you got to go.
Yeah.
That's fair. That's,
you know, building a facility, you could tell when the facility was built because there was no women's restroom on the entire floor. I think there was only one in the whole building, wasn't there?
There was, yeah.
Yeah.
Were there two water fountains?
it's that era. Yeah.
I think that building is newer than the one surrounding it, but
oh god.
It's definitely new, and I think
you think
just
so?
Like,
yeah.
Oh yeah. It smells newer, at least.
It smells newer. All the water was terrible, though.
The water was awful.
I think that this is really interesting that you broke this down into situational, temporary, and permanent. I think that that's a really effective way to look at something really,
yeah,
like
I like
this.
That, because that's not something I never really, you always kind of think worst case scenario, but that's all relevant, relevant things. I would have never put that into perspective like that.
Oh, sorry, I was going to say, you don't really always appreciate like places where environments fell short until you like experience some of those temporary things. Like when you're outside and you're trying to look at your phone, but it's so bright that you can't see anything. Like,
yeah,
that's a pain.
Oh, one of the things that Dennis had us do in that day of experiments was you had to pick up a newspaper, but you had to cross traffic. And you basically were wearing frosted lenses. So it was like you had cataracts. And crossing traffic and not being able to see is one of the, it is terribly frightening. Mm-hmm. I mean, we had somebody with us when we did it, but it was still terribly, terribly frightening.
Yeah.
So, you know, and that's when you really realize what the auditory signaling on the signage, just how important that is. And you start to realize these things. I couldn't imagine having to do that. And I know that humans are amazing and that they can adapt, but it still is a situation where if you're going across traffic, even if you're holding somebody's arm, that's still a very unsettling situation.
It really is.
You know, there's often a question about like what the difference is between accessibility and usability. And we kind of touched on a little bit earlier how making something accessible doesn't necessarily mean that it is usable or acceptable, but making something accessible by accommodating assistive technology and adhering to accessibility guidelines goes a long way in making sure that everyone can use your product. And again, I am kind of like thinking about this in my day-to-day work in like digital design, but I mean, this goes for physical like product design and environmental design as well. So
the idea that accessibility and usability are two mutually exclusive concepts, would you agree with that?
For anyone that needs to use assistive technology, yes, they are mutually exclusive. They cannot, if you need to use a screen reader and that site is not accessible and it can't be read by your assistive technology, then it's not usable for you.
Yeah.
Flat out.
Yeah.
Canvas at the moment will warn you if you've created layouts that are not accessible. So it'll basically say, hey, these things, somebody who has software reading them, so on, they won't be able to see this. Like some people will, and you know how this is, you deal with educators. There's all sorts of different skill levels as far as being able to upload things. And if you get individuals who like somehow output a giant JPEG of their syllabus and they stick it in,
yeah,
and it's like, no one can see this. Sorry, yep. No one can read this. This giant pixelated document you just stuck in your syllabus. Yeah, it's really interesting to watch that, because I remember a time when that kind of management software didn't have really any of that built into it. And now it's really nice to know that it's there.
I also remember like a couple of years ago, I was not part of this study, but some of my coworkers traveled to another university just to observe folks with low vision like use the product that we were working on. And they got to see like people that zoomed in to the interface at like 400 magnification, and we realized like, oh, this is a bad experience, because like when they zoom in that far, that you lose all of the context of the rest of the page, and then it becomes more difficult to understand like what it is that you're looking at. And, you know, I mentioned earlier that user testing and going through you know, validation tools will also just kind of like automatically test at least digital products to make sure that they're compliant. I think that was something like I didn't appreciate until, you know, I saw videos and pictures of like how painful that experience was.
That is very interesting to say that if you're zoomed in like that, that you lose the context of the rest of the page.
Right. Mm-hmm. Lauren has brought things to light for me. I have to say,
yeah.
you've enlightened me this episode. Like we were talking about, just like obviously we're talking about the difference between usability and accessibility, but you also just brought up the word acceptable.
And there was kind of this trend a couple years ago where a lot of products as like an accessibility remediation would just put kind of like a widget in the bottom corner of their page. You may have seen these before. It often had like the person icon in the corner and you can click on it and then you can manually adjust all of these accessibility settings. And on the surface, that seems fine. But in reality, like that, for the same reason that you just said, Dan, that is not an acceptable experience because it does highlight and it creates hurdles for folks that use assistive technology because now they are in a position where they have to like manually tweak a website that should just work for them. Like,
right. Well,
and I imagine that creates user fatigue after a while.
Oh, yeah. Like the cognitive load of just like always having to like think about if you're going to have to like change the settings on the site that you're visiting. Like, yeah.
Well, I can imagine like, you know, there are some services that I have to use, you know, Microsoft services where there you have to log in with all your credentials multiple times to access different parts of a system. And if that's frustrating, I can imagine that if you're going from one site to another, and you have to deal with the accessibility issues, that has to be just frustrating and cause fatigue.
Okay, we realize life is hard. We're going to make it a little harder.
Right.
Yes. Yes.
Also, we're going to highlight how hard it is for you, actually.
And we're going to put you on blast to everyone so that they look at you and they know that you're having a hard time.
Now, those are some examples of design solutions that don't work. And, you know, those tools advertise that they exist to avoid lawsuits, which is unfortunate
just an altruistic pursuit.
Right.
Yeah.
Why did there ever have to be a lawsuit in the first place?
Right. Unfortunately, that is kind of the way that you often have to advocate for accessibility remediation because lawsuits are expensive and money is what some organizations respond to. So we've kind of touched, I think, on accessibility. Like I said, I mean, I've touched a lot on digital. Environmental design is probably the thing that most folks think of initially. Physical, like product design is really interesting and just kind of thinking about, you know, built environments, especially in North America, you see kind of like when a sidewalk kind of butts up against an intersection, there's a part of the sidewalk that kind of like slants and like turns into a little ramp going into the street.
Yeah.
And it's often like raised. Whatever's in there, they have names. I forget what they are. Those are called curb cuts, and they were initially created to accommodate folks in wheelchairs so that they can independently and safely cross the street. But the thing is, curb cuts also benefit folks who are pushing children in strollers or pushing a cart full of groceries or people in rollerblades, bikes. They help everyone, and that's what the curb cut effect is. It's basically acknowledging that design solutions that might initially be designed to accommodate or solve for a specific disability actually end up creating a better experience universally for everybody. Another famous example of this is actually the OXO, like vegetable peeler. That was made initially for folks with arthritis, so that it was more ergonomic. But guess what? Yeah. It's ergonomic for everyone. Like, it's just better.
Lauren, did you ever read Don Norman's The Design of Everyday Things?
I think I did years ago. Yeah.
Yeah. Kind of the grandfather of UX design, which, you know, that the Norman Nielsen group.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That book is brilliant because it talks about a lot of these types mm-hmm. of things.
Required reading. I should read it again.
That Understanding Comics, if you never read that, you should. Even if you're not into comics as a visual creative, you need to mm-hmm. read Understanding Comics. That was required in the master's.
It was required in the undergraduate program, I think, before you came along. I had to read it because it's like it's a comic book, right? It's like
right.
Yeah, I have that downstairs.
Yeah, fantastic, Dan. If you've never read that,
I have not.
You should get it. It's like $15. It's Understanding Comics, and it's one of these books that's required in a lot of grad programs. You would totally dig this book. It's mm-hmm. life changing for some individuals, and Mark,
I have no real education. So
you do have an education.
Being self-taught is still education.
Prison is an education.
It's true.
See, I want to say, as Kristen can tell you, but she would be offended by that. Prison people are people too.
They are. Yeah, I'll definitely check it out.
Yeah, my current colleague, when he was in grad school, I had him read that book, and he was just like, it completely changed all of his grad work.
Huh. Yeah.
Incredible. Yeah, it's funny. The like freshman students, they're like, this is magic. This is what is happening. What is this book? And it's all one gigantic comic.
It is. Huh. It's really well done.
Yeah, it's so well done.
Book because it was really... What I remember taking away from it was how to tell a really good story.
In a way, accessible design, kind of this is how it fits in. Accessible design, if you have a smiley face on one end of the spectrum, and then you have like a realistic charcoal drawing on the other end of the spectrum. And what happens is that if you are on the hyper-realistic side of the spectrum and you use that in any type of a design, individuals will perceive that as being only for people or individuals who share those characteristics. The closer that you get to the smiley face, the more people will relate to the message that you're trying to give.
Yeah.
Which is why you see a lot of things like, you know, emojis, for example, even though you do have some specifics, like you can change skin color, things like that with emojis, the emojis are actually pretty generic looking individuals. It's really cool.
Accessibility kind of has this massive overlap with just inclusivity in mm-hmm. general. It bleeds into your iconography, your tone of voice, your visual, just kind of design that we can do a whole other episode on just that. And it's really, really cool. There's a lot of really cool resources out there that just talk about inclusivity specifically, just universal design. In like video games where you have a lot of control over the way that your character looks, I think most people on the first playthrough at least try to make their person like look as much like them as possible.
Yeah.
But I personally, like, it's such a small thing, and this is more like inclusivity related, but like there are so few hairstyles that in video game avatars that I feel like look like mine. Like my hair texture is, it's almost always portrayed on like an African American person instead. And glasses often aren't that like common And when they are, they look kind of dorky and bad. And like, I think recently, like, games have gotten a lot better with that. Like, Hogwarts Legacy was, I think, really, really good. Like, my person looked just like me, but
yeah, their character creation in that game is insane.
Do you know how many video game characters are bald with a beard? A lot.
Yeah.
A lot. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
I am certainly not putting this on the same level as physical disabilities, but one of the things that I'm starting to see in higher education is this desire to design for limited attention spans.
Oh, I feel that.
Yeah. Yeah. And just scrambling towards a way to keep the attention of individuals who have no attention span. And it's not, you know, anything that I'm going to say, I'm just going to sound old, but cell phones are a damn problem. And I've had more cell phones than most people. I mean, you know, back to the Saved by the Bell days, the big Zach Morris phones. It's a problem. It is a serious problem. And what I've found is that I'm pacing the classes differently because I know that their attention span is only so, it is only so long before they're wandering off. And it's like, when I started doing this, I did not have to do that in any way, shape, or form. But now it's like, if I don't give a break, like every 20 minutes, they're just gone. I mean,
it's a hard balance, right? Because on some level, like, it's just a good design practice to chunk information out in a way that minimizes the cognitive load it takes to, like, digest the information. And that's a good, like, learning experience design practice too. It's like chunking information out. It is a tough balance though, because I've thought about this in my work too, like how does, like, the way that we design our courses affect the future attention span of the students? Or, like, you know, it's generally good practice to, when you're writing, like, micro copy, keep it to, like, a sixth grade reading level. Sure. But at what point are you going to have to, like, go down to fourth grade? And, like, it gets, like, hard.
Well, and I think I've talked about this with Dan before. The average screen time for Gen Z is, like, 9-point-some-odd hours a day. I mean, I have students that I'm like, just out of curiosity, what is your screen time on your iPhone? And it's
my screen.
It's 8.5-9 hours a day.
A lot.
That is a lot. And that's average.
I feel like you get two kinds of Zoomers. You get those that, like, are, like, can't be asked to look up from their screen. And then you have ones that, like, reject it entirely.
Yeah.
Like, those are the two I've encountered, and there's not much of an in-between.
No. I love Gen Z. I think that they're fantastic, but mainly because Gen Xers are the ones who raised them. So I get their sense of humor. They have our sense of humor. But it's genuinely becoming an issue. There are people who are just, and you know, there are people who are just throwing their hands up and they're just like, I can't fight it. Can't fight it any longer. It's sad because I think one of Gen Z's strong points is they have that, well, if somebody else can do it, I can do it. I don't understand why I can't type of attitude, but they can't concentrate long enough to to do what they need to do. So Lauren, do you have any ideas or do you have any recommendations for individuals who are interested in this design subject? Do you have any ideas for where they could go? What, you know, any type of resources where somebody could become a little bit more educated in this subject?
Yeah. So there's often, you know, some kind of like meetup group, or a lot of conferences often have speakers that talk specifically about accessibility. There's actually a week-long conference called AxCon that happens once a year. I think it happened like a month or so ago now. They put all the recordings up online.
Ax is an A-X-E-Con?
A-X-E-C-O-N.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
They put on a great conference every year. It's all about accessibility, and it gets like really broad. It also gets really, really specific. It's hosted by DEQ or DQS. I actually don't know how to pronounce it. DEQUE Systems. They put that on every year. So that's really great. There's also tons and tons of free resources out there. There are certifications if you are really interested in pursuing this as a niche. A certification in accessibility looks really, really good, and it makes you stand out kind of an expert in that area.
And I think the Norman Nielsen group on YouTube has some videos related to this.
They do.
Yeah.
They have ranging from like digital accessibility all the way to like designing for different developmental stages of life. Like when I was building an app for like, it was an iPad app meant to be used by 3 to 12-year-olds. And so it's like designing for people that don't yet have gross motor skills. Like, how is that different from designing, you know, a typical application? They're a fantastic resource too.
All right. So this has been OK Team, a Young Designer's Guide. My name is Mark Sela.
I'm Dan Lawson, and this has been our special guest host,
Lauren DeMarks.
Why does American cheese taste better when it melts? Like a slice of regular American cheese, does rip the plastic off of it and eat it is fantastic. But for some reason, when it melts, it gets better.
The cheese pool is unreal. Like,
this is what you need at the beginning here. Yeah. Right here. This is the opening.
Yep.
Oh, man. The cheese.
That happened naturally.